It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. Later in this hour, Minnesota and Wisconsin have gone in different directions politically in recent years. We'll talk to New York Times reporter who visited the Twin Ports area to see that clear, stark contrast between the two states.
Earlier today, President Obama called for changes to the NSA's phone data collection program in a speech that addressed a domestic and international audience.
In his talk, President Obama stressed concerns about the balance between privacy and security in government surveillance. U.S. surveillance practices have been making headlines around the world since Edward Snowden began leaking classified NSA documents in June of last year.
Since those leaks began, many have called for reforms to the program, and there has been particular concern with programs like PRISM that mine internet data from around the world and programs that collect phone data in the U.S. and Europe. Here with us to talk about President Obama's speech is Stephen Vladek. He's a professor of law and associate dean for scholarship at American University Washington College of Law. Stephen, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So the biggest news out of President Obama's speech is that he's going to be ending the NSA's phone metadata collection program as it exists today. Let's listen to a clip from the speech.
I believe critics are right to point out that without proper safeguards, this type of program could be used to yield more information about our private lives and open the door to more intrusive bulk collection programs in the future. They're also right to point out that although the telephone bulk collection program was subject to oversight by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and has been reauthorized repeatedly by Congress, it has never been subject to vigorous public debate. For all these reasons, I believe we need a new approach. I am therefore ordering a transition that will end the Section 215 bulk metadata program as it currently exists and establish a mechanism that preserves the capabilities we need without the government holding this bulk metadata.
All right, so a lot going on in that clip from the speech there. I hear some concessions being made to critics and also some indications that changes are going to be made. What do you hear?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, I hear sort of a lot of steps in both directions. I think the real problem is what I don't hear is the president saying the government is going to stop collecting this data. The proposal that President Obama made in his speech today is to change how the government queries the data once they have it, and even then, only for a short term until this issue has to be resolved by Congress later this year. So I actually think it was a bit of an overstatement on the president's part to say that he's going to end the program. What's really going to happen is he's going to scale it back, at least until and unless Congress decides to reauthorize it.
So he is offering up the NSA surveillance programs to greater scrutiny, as he said. But, I mean, is it open for interpretation, I guess, about what that might actually mean?
Yes, I mean, so at least in the short term, in the transitional period that President Obama referred to in that clip, you know, I think what he's envisioning is a little bit more oversight, a little bit more work by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court before the government can actually go into this database and query it. They have to now get approval from this secret court. But the devil's in the details. I mean, what are they going to have to do to get that approval? This is only going to be a temporary short-term solution. And even still, he said nothing about the government stopping the collection of this data, only about what the government can do once it has it. So in many ways, I actually think the speech leaves more questions than it answers.
And one of the questions that I have is that if it's out of the hands of the government, the metadata being collected, does that mean it could potentially be in the hands of a third party?
Certainly. I mean, I think one of the reforms that's being proposed in Congress, and I think President Obama, you know, made it quite clear that it's not going to be up to Congress, is to continue to have this data out there, but to have it stored by the phone companies and then only accessible by the government once it can actually meet some kind of individualized suspicion standard. That, you know, that trades one set of privacy concerns with regard to how much information the government has on us for another, which is how much information private companies are retaining, potentially for years and years at a time, and with fewer and fewer, you know, restrictions on how they use that information. So, you know, in many ways, I actually think the speech only sort of provokes the conversation rather than trying to resolve it.
Do you think, in a sense, it could be a passing of the buck, saying, well, you know, if the government's not in charge of it, someone else is, then maybe perhaps it's their problem a little bit more than it is the government's?
Oh, not only, I mean, it's certainly a passing of the buck. I would say in the short term, it's more a passing of the buck not to private companies, but to Congress. I mean, I think there's no question that Congress is thinking about how to reform these programs. There are already a couple of competing proposals that have been introduced in both houses. And so in many ways, I think what the president is saying, at least with regard to the phone records program, is I'm going to impose some short-term restrictions on how the government uses information, but long-term restrictions, long-term changes, I'm going to leave that up to the legislature. And in that regard, I think it's a missed opportunity for the president to have actually said how he feels and taken a position about what metadata collection should look like going forward.
And another thing that came up in his speech, he seemed to be addressing part of it to pacifying international allies who have been a little ticked off at the U.S. for surveillance. Angela Merkel is one example. What did he have to say about international surveillance and how the U.S. is going to manage that going forward?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, this was actually perhaps the more politically or at least diplomatically important part of the speech. So the president said that going forward, he's going to instruct the intelligence agencies that they shouldn't spy on foreign leaders like Chancellor Merkel just because they can, but that rather they should have to have some kind of national security-based reason why collecting specific intelligence from foreign leaders is actually beneficial to U.S. interests. That's actually a very helpful way to think of the problem, but again, the devil's in the details. What does it mean for the National Security Agency to have a specific national security interest in intercepting Angela Merkel's phone calls? Indeed, how will they know which phone calls to intercept if they're not listening to all of them? So, you know, like most of the rest of the speech, we heard a lot of rhetoric that actually makes a lot of sense and seems like a reasonable compromise position, but there's so much room to fill in the gaps in either direction, in the favor of, you know, much greater privacy and civil liberties protections or in the favor of the status quo.
And he wasn't above, you know, kind of prodding foreign leaders abroad who he said expressed surprise at this when they're actually doing the same thing to the United States.
That's right. And, you know, I think President Obama feels it's a little bit of, you know, sort of the inspector from Casablanca. You know, everyone's shocked to find gambling going on in this establishment. But, you know, in that regard, I do think that there's a difference between what every country knows the other countries are doing and what's public. And so clearly the president had to do something to at least look like he's trying to mollify our friends and partners overseas. I think he actually took a big step in that direction today. The question now becomes just how much of a constraint is this national security-based restriction going to be going forward?
How important was it for President Obama to address this today? Do you think he pretty much had to do this?
Well, you know, I think the real sort of provocation here was his own review group. I mean, so the president had this five-member panel that he personally selected to basically look at NSA surveillance programs, to report back to him, to make recommendations. And, you know, that group came back with about 46 specific concrete recommendations just before the new year. And so, you know, there was no question that once the review group delivered its report, the president was going to have to do something. And so I guess in some sense that was the purpose of today's speech. But if the goal was to take a position on what the review group said, I think today's speech does leave a lot to be desired. There were 46 recommendations in the review group report. You know, the president today at best spoke to maybe five or six of them and left really unclear just what he and his administration are going to do, to what position they're going to take when it comes to implementing some of these other reforms that his own review group called for.
So if he only addressed five or six of 46 recommendations by the review group, what do you think is a key that he maybe should have addressed and left out? Were there other major oversights in his speech?
Well, you know, I think one of the larger questions here that I think is getting a bit sort of pushed to the side by the focus on the metadata program is the sort of structure of oversight for all of our intelligence activities. I mean, there's, you know, a compromise that was struck back in the 1970s where Congress basically signed off on the government having all of this power to conduct all kinds of foreign intelligence in exchange for the government agreeing to far greater congressional and judicial oversight than had previously been the norm. But one of the things we've learned from Snowden is that those oversight mechanisms haven't worked, or at least haven't worked nearly as well as Congress intended. And so I think, you know, one of the questions that has to be asked, but that no one, at least in Congress or in the, you know, president's administration, seem to be asking right now is, should we really be revisiting this compromise on a fundamental level? Should we be rethinking the entire structure of how we do national security intelligence gathering and national security oversight in light of all of the abuses that Edward Snowden has exposed?
Stephen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Stephen Vladek, professor of law and associate dean for scholarship at American University Washington College of Law, talking about President Obama's speech today regarding NSA surveillance.
Next, Superior and Duluth may be twins, but they aren't identical. We'll talk to a New York Times reporter who visited the Twin Ports area to see the differences between how Wisconsin and Minnesota govern themselves.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. Coming up, Noah Obshinsky will catch us up on the top Wisconsin news of the week.
First, Superior, Wisconsin and Duluth, Minnesota are often called the Twin Ports. The close neighbors have a lot in common, but our next guest says there's a big difference in recent years, the partisan politics of their states, with Minnesota under a Democratic governor and legislature and Wisconsin under Republican control.
Monica Davey joins us now. She's a Midwest reporter for the New York Times, and her piece on Duluth and Superior, Twin Cities Now Following Different Paths, was published this past weekend. Monica, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you work for a newspaper with a national scale. Why was it important to tell the story of the differences between Wisconsin and Minnesota?
Well, I think what we're doing, we're trying to do, is tell the story of sort of what's happening in lots of states. So we picked Minnesota and Wisconsin because they're a good example of a larger trend that's going on. So what you have going around the, in the country is there are 36 states that are under single-party control, either Democrats, all Democrats, or all Republicans. And that's the most that we've had since 1952. So it's making some dramatic differences. And Minnesota and Wisconsin seemed like a really good way to tell that story and to tell how that's actually affecting people's lives on the ground, not just in some state capital somewhere.
And it shows how that's sitting basically side by side. You have Minnesota and Wisconsin, you know, in a lot of ways very similar, right? I mean, in terms of looking at the states, but treating things differently.
I think that's really true. I mean, lots of people I've talked to and people up there gave me the sense that they're culturally the same in many ways, that they sort of life has felt the same in many ways there over a long period of time. And when you have Duluth and Superior, I guess the beauty of them being right next to each other, you really have people who are living not just in one or the other city, but they spend, you know, they may work in Duluth and live in Superior or vice versa. They eat meals in different, you know, the different cities. It's really sort of a porous border there. People go in between. And so it feels particularly dramatic to have such different policies coming down in two different states when they're only a couple miles apart in a place like Duluth and Superior.
Now, could you talk a little bit about some of the differences you noticed or as you talked to people? I know that you spoke to some people who were educators and they lived on one side of the border and taught on the other. And
that's right. Well, I think that obviously you all know as Wisconsinites, you know that there have been a lot of changes for public sector collective bargaining in Wisconsin since 2011. That was a big issue there, and certainly it's gotten lots of coverage. But what I saw was that if you actually live in a place like Superior, Wisconsin, you have felt it. If you are a teacher and a family there, the family that I spoke to had really felt some financial pain from it. They're paying more for their health care, higher contributions to their pensions. And so, you know, Kim Smith, the woman that I met with there, she's actually gone from being a part-time teacher to a full-time teacher, and it was because they needed the money. They needed to increase the income at, you know, sometime shortly after the 2011 changes. So again, what struck me was this dramatic difference there on the ground. Now, on the other side of that, you've got a business owner in Duluth who has watched the business taxes in Minnesota, something called business-to-business taxes there, go up. And he's deeply concerned about this. That's affecting his life, affecting his business. And he said that, you know, when he looks at the laws that have changed in Minnesota, which, again, is controlled now by all Democrats, that if he were opening his company there now, he would give a second thought to whether he would actually do that in Minnesota. So, again, I guess what I saw was really life diverging.
Now, did you get a sense from the people that you talked to that this might affect how they vote in the future or anything like that, sort of based on being able to see, you know, the other side of the fence, so to speak? Do you think that seemed to have an influence on how people might want to think about things in the future?
Yeah, I think it certainly has to. I mean, if your lives are affected so directly, it has a big impact. I talked to a gay couple who lives in on the Wisconsin side, and they're making a serious effort to move to the Duluth side because they feel that same-sex marriage is very important to them. Obviously, Minnesota made that legal in August, and Wisconsin has not moved similarly. So for some a couple like them, this has a pretty major impact. Now, I'm sure there are lots of people in both of those cities who haven't felt this sort of as intently as some of the people that I spoke to. I think one thing that's interesting, though, if you look at Wisconsin and Minnesota and you look at the 2012 election, the presidential election, the states voted nearly identically. They favored Obama, both states did, and the vote was almost the same. So the interesting piece of that, I mean, what it tells you is that they still, it's not that the people who live in these states are so vastly different now. I think it's largely that you're seeing the changes in the capitals.
Is it unusual to see a situation like Minnesota and Wisconsin that are sort of culturally so similar, having such different politics in each state like that?
I think it's very different. I mean, I think that most of us think to ourselves, well, you know, there are states like Kansas that are you know, Republicans have always done very well there, or California, where Democrats now control both chambers of the legislature and the governor's office. And those don't surprise us as much. I think it's a little more surprising when you see a Minnesota and a Wisconsin, and knowing that their history and their culture has been largely the same, that they, you know, really aside from the Packers and the Vikings, they don't have that much to argue about. And yet, these things are going in really dramatically different directions. And actually, my colleague wrote a story that explained part of why that is. It's partly something that's happened naturally, but it's also by virtue of money being raised and spent to win over control of states. People have seen opportunities elsewhere around the country in other states and are sending money in to win control, both of democratically controlled states and of Republican controlled states.
Now, in some ways, it seems like a place like the Twin Ports may benefit from the fact that they have both. I mean, you know, from an economic perspective, if you look at the region, did you get a sense of that when you were there, or was that sort of outside of the scope of your article?
Oh, you mean the idea that they get a little taste of everything?
Right.
Yeah, I guess that's an interesting way to look at it. I hadn't really thought about it that way. I mean, I think the interesting thing is this is all happening right now. I mean, Minnesota became all democratically held in the legislature just in 2013. So to some degree, the people in Duluth and Superior, they're looking at these individual changes in their lives, and they're not yet seeing how does this play out long term? Do we become less and less alike, or will, you know, next year both of those states, not next year, this year, 2014, both of those states have important governor's races, and in a way it'll be a test of one-party control. It'll be a test to say, did Minnesotans and people who live in Duluth, did they feel good about the dramatic changes that Democrats in St. Paul made? And the same goes for on the Wisconsin side and the changes that Governor Walker has made in Madison. These are really, really interesting elections because of these dramatic changes that are going on.
So, so in some ways, do you think that maybe the election cycle that's coming up do you think it could shift things in some ways? And maybe somewhere like Wisconsin, where we do have a lot of people who live along borders, whether it's the Illinois border or Iowa or Minnesota, do you think that might make it easier for people to start thinking about how the politics are going in their state?
I think there are a lot of elements that go into what happens in the elections in November, but I do think this is a really important test of one-party control of states. We have, again, this is the most states that have single-party control in state capitals that we've had in, you know, more than half a century, and now it's time to test, do we like that or not? Do people feel as though the policies you can get a lot more done if you have control of an entire capital. You can pass your agenda in a way that we've seen in Washington. They can't always do very well with divided government. So the question then is left to the voters whether they like it or not. Do they like the agenda that their one-party controlled capital has passed? And that'll be a really interesting test. And it's a test all over the country. In my region, you've got great similar tests of that in, you know, Michigan, Illinois, the places that have had single party control, Ohio, Pennsylvania, we're going to see, did people like it or not?
Well, our guest is Monica Davey with the New York Times. We're talking about her piece comparing Duluth and Superior, basically looking at Minnesota and Wisconsin in comparison. And
we want to hear from you. And we wonder if you see differences in state policies having a big impact on the border. If you're in Minnesota or Wisconsin, do you ever hop the border to take advantage of what the other side has to offer? And for those of you not in the area, what do you think of the ways partisan control of the two states is affecting your life? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page or email us at talk@WPR.org.
We'll continue the conversation after the news. You can join us, though, at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Join the conversation after the news. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold, filling in for Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Monica Davey of the New York Times. She wrote a piece comparing the Twin Ports, Duluth and Superior, highlighting the different approaches taken by state lawmakers in Wisconsin and Minnesota.
And we'd love to hear from you now. You can join in with your thoughts and your questions at 1-800-642-1234. What about you? Would you consider leaving or moving to Wisconsin for political reasons?
Do you cross over to Minnesota to do anything, or would you consider moving to Minnesota? We'd like to hear your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. I'd like to bring Monica Davey back on. Monica, you had said that one of the reasons you looked at Wisconsin and Minnesota is because there are more states that have sort of a single-party government thing going on right now. And this is at a time when there seems to be more political polarization than ever. Why do you think those two things happen at the same time?
You know, I think that's an interesting question. There are lots of answers to that are probably correct. I do think I think people are fed up with sort of dysfunction of Washington, and sometimes divided government doesn't look like the most efficient way to go. You end up with shutdowns and that sort of thing. And certainly when you have one party in control, you can get a lot done. I think there are also some demographic reasons why that would just naturally be the case that, you know, there's certainly states where we know, you know, that have always sort of leaned Democratic or always leaned Republican, and there's really no surprise to that. And they're changing numbers of people moving in and out. And so there's some demographic reasons that make sense for that. I think, but I do think that finances have had a big influence on this. And I think what we found at the New York Times was that there are plans to get when there's national money that's being spent on some of these state races, where people are saying, well, look, it looks as though this particular state capital could be put all in Republican control or all in Democratic control, and then we could get some of the things we want done, so let's send money that way. And so that's part of, I think, the reason for it.
Well, let's go to the phones. 1-800-642-1234 is a number to call if you want to join. Let's go to Jim in Superior. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I live in Superior, and I work over in Duluth. And we noticed in our place of work that there was an influx of people from Wisconsin when the policies changed over. Do you have any information or data? Has there been better job growth in one state or the other because of these policies?
Is it that you noticed people were moving for their jobs, or they were literally moving their homes?
I'm a teacher, and it was people moving to try and get employment in Minnesota to teach in Minnesota rather than Wisconsin.
Yeah, I watched and heard lots of debate over this, and I think that in 5 years we'll be able to make a really good judgment on this. I mean, again, I heard from both states and talked to officials there, And I think that the problem is that it's a little bit too new to know really what the outcome is. You know, Madison went to one party control with Republicans in 2011, and Minnesota went to all Democrats in 2013. So you know, I think a good example is that the couple that I talked to who said, you know, they want to put their house on the market, but they aren't quite there yet. You know, they haven't done it yet. So I think that we will, if these states stay in single party control and if Duluth and Superior continue to head on these diverging paths, I think we'll see those numbers play out maybe 5 years from now. I think it's a little premature to say.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Jim. I really appreciate it. We're talking to Monica Davey of the New York Times. She wrote a piece comparing the Twin Ports, Duluth and Superior, basically showing the political differences between Wisconsin and Minnesota and highlighting that. And we're also hearing from you if you want to join the conversation. Do you live on the border? Have you considered leaving Wisconsin for Minnesota or other places for political reasons? Have you noticed that there's this difference in politics in the states? We'd like you to join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And let's go to Nate in Milwaukee. Nate, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me. I was going to mention that in addition to money, which I think definitely has an impact in politics, in Wisconsin, you've got gerrymandering of legislative districts, which basically means one party drew the map to favor itself, and this was apparent in Wisconsin, where more people actually voted to have a Democrat represent themselves in the state legislature, and yet the other party represents the majority or has a majority of the seats. In Minnesota, there's a difference because the maps are not gerrymandered there, so the people actually have a political choice on the state legislature level, and it can switch back and forth, and it actually does.
Nate, I think that's a really good point. We saw this, you know, this is what's happening around the country, so that once you do have single-party control, in lots of states, they do, every 10 years, get to redraw the maps. And so if you have control, it's somewhat easier then to keep control because of the gerrymandering, yes.
So it's a very complicated mix of things, then, that you're dealing with here, then, Monica?
I think that's right. I mean, I think it really is a whole, and it's different in different states. And again, there are some states that have always been in, you know, Republican or Democratic control. And what makes it interesting, and what I think the best test cases then are the places like Wisconsin and Minnesota, which, you know, to some degree are considered purple, which can go back and forth and have had their moments of control in either party. And we're just seeing it now in a really stark way there, and it makes it really interesting study. You know, one thing about single party control is that it's sort of made the states, as opposed to Washington, which we're used to, it's made the states this testing ground for all sorts of policies, you know, on gay marriage, on taxation, on you know, health care, on all sorts of issues. The states have really become this really, really busy testing ground to sort of see which policy works, what works best.
And do you think that could be part of the reason why we're seeing a lot of, you know, sort of state legislation in some areas that you would not expect states to move forward with, things like legalizing marijuana and different issues like that?
I think that's right. I think that again, you've seen some of the most dramatic legislation over the past couple of years with this single-party control. There was a big Republican wave in the 2010 elections, and then you had some places like Colorado and Minnesota in the 2012 elections. And so those states are testing out a variety of policies, and we're seeing how they play out.
We're talking about states with the single political party leading them, like Wisconsin or Minnesota. Jim from Muskego joins us now. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I just wanted to make comment. I moved from Michigan to Wisconsin.
Uh-huh. Jim, are you still there? I think we lost Jim. Basically, he said that he moved to Wisconsin for political reasons, from Michigan, actually. And it seems like that actually could be one of the side effects, I suppose, of this change, don't you think, Monica?
Well, that's interesting. I couldn't hear much of what he was saying, but if he was moving from Michigan, one of the interesting things about Michigan is that it, too, is a state that went to single-party control in that 2010 Republican wave. And so Michigan, too, is now dominated in both chambers of its legislature and in the governor's office by Republicans, and it's done its own set of changes, which are seen as dramatic tests, sort of Republican policy and what's going to work. They passed right-to-work legislation there last year, and that's been very controversial. So I'm curious to know what led Jim to move from Michigan, but I guess he's no longer with us.
Yes, I think that will continue to be a mystery for us. But John from Grand Rapids is on the line. So, John, you want to join the conversation here on Central Time?
Yeah, I'm actually originally from Superior. I have a lot of relatives in Duluth, Superior area, and am considering, I'm in central Wisconsin at the moment, been here about 25 years, but with all the activity of political turn to the right in Wisconsin, I am considering leaving Wisconsin and moving back up into the, northern Minnesota.
And why is that?
I'm not happy with Act 10. I'm not happy with the Tea Party attitude towards public employees. I'm not happy with my employer, etc. But also, I wonder too, like if you guys can remember, because Superior is in such a unique situation in terms of the geography of the state and the distance from the state capital. We're actually 150 miles from St. Paul, but we're 320 miles from Madison. Do you recall? I know there's been talk when I was growing up in the 70s, and I think it had started actually earlier in the several decades prior to that, that some talk of northern Michigan, the UP, northern Wisconsin, and northern Minnesota becoming the 51st state, and they're going to call it Superior. I wondered if you had heard of that talk, if any of that's ever been resurrected. I haven't heard of it in years.
John, that's a good question. Monica, you may not have heard of that. But
I sure haven't, but what an interesting idea. No, I hadn't heard about that.
Well, I think we'll have to end on that note. You have any final thoughts on this? Do you expect to do additional coverage related to this issue?
We are doing. We're going to continue writing about one-party rule across the country and sort of what it is meant. And I guess my final thought would just be that I would be watching the coming elections through this lens. I think it's a really, really interesting test of whether people like what they're seeing or whether they don't. And I'll be curious to see how much of that comes up. It'll be really interesting to see how the governor in Minnesota does and how the governor in Wisconsin does and how this issue plays out. Maybe we'll see by after November, maybe we will have, you know, fewer than ever single-party controlled states. Maybe people will reject it, but I think it'll be a moment of testing for this one-party rule.
Well, Monica, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Monica Davey is the Midwest reporter for The New York Times.
Coming up on Central Time, we'll check in on the top stories of the week in Wisconsin news, including new estimates of how much money the state is taking in. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. This week marked the opening of the legislative session here in Wisconsin, but that wasn't the only thing making news in Wisconsin. Every Friday, WPR's Assistant News Director Noah Ovshinsky joins us to keep us up to date, and we'll also be talking to reporter Gilman Halstead for a few minutes about a new WPR series.
Noah, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be here. Thanks, Veronica.
So pretty busy news week here in Wisconsin. What tops your news list this week?
Well, I'd say number one is probably the news of the budget surplus. Apparently, the state government will have more money in their coffers than they expected. Something to the tune of around $911 million.
That sounds like a lot to me. Is that a lot for the government?
I think it's quite a bit. And this money is basically higher than expected tax revenue. And in this case, you know, we're talking about higher than expected income taxes, sales taxes, as well as corporate taxes.
So obviously, big extra pot of money. That's never bad news.
Never, especially for legislators.
Especially for legislators. So that has to have people already jumping up and down trying to figure out what they're going to do with this money.
Of course.
So what kind of ideas are floated? Let's start with Governor Walker.
Sure. So we know so much. We only know so much about the governor. The governor, through his spokesperson, has said that they'd like to use it towards property taxes of some kind and income tax cuts. As far as the specifics, we're going to hear about those in his State of the State speech, which is in the middle of next week. So as far as what he's thinking, we'll hear about that next week. But some of that money, at least, is probably going to go to some kind of property or income tax cut or both.
Now, according to some people, some advocates, we are in an era of fiscal responsibility. Is there someone already talking about using this money to pay down the state debt instead?
Yeah. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald hasn't committed to one particular plan yet, but he has said that his members would like to save at least some of that money, both in a rainy day fund and also potentially use some of that money to pay down the structural deficit that the government faces.
And what about other folks in the Assembly? What are they thinking?
So Assembly Democratic Minority Leader Peter Barkas, we're talking about the Democrats here. You know, they say some of the money should be used for tax relief, but that it should also be used for education and job training. And when we're talking about tax relief and Democrats, they would like to see that directed towards the middle class. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss is also talking about tax relief. He would like at least some of that to come from reduced property taxes that are levied and collected by technical colleges in Wisconsin. So he'd like to see that bill go down as well.
So a lot of options on the table, but it seems likely that we'll be looking at some form of tax relief.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a foregone conclusion at this point. Again, we'll find out more about what the governor's thinking next week during his State of the State address.
WPR News has been tracking a new piece of legislation, a bill requiring a minority impact statement when it comes to matters regarding crime. Can you break down what a minority impact statement would involve?
So this is a piece of legislation that is sponsored by State Senator Nakia Harris. And basically what it requires is that any new crime-related bill, we could talk about penalties, that sort of thing, associated with a particular crime, this legislation requires that those bill, when it's being drafted, be evaluated for what effect it will have on minorities. And lawmakers are calling this a racial impact study. It's kind of like the studies that some legislators have called for that look at the financial implications of this crime-related legislation. This will actually look at what impact it may have on a particular minority group.
And other states have this already, right?
Yeah, I believe three states have similar laws, including Iowa.
Now, as far as the advocates of this bill, what goal are they hoping to achieve with it?
Right. Well, for the backers of this bill, they feel it will help address, at least one very troubling statistic, namely the fact that here in Wisconsin right now, one out of every eight black males is currently incarcerated. And that's something that they feel that this racial impact study could help address.
Now, as I heard in one of our newscasts on this topic, other states have looked at this and opponents have weighed in. What does some of the opposition say to this?
Right. So this kind of approach does have its critics. In fact, Gilman Halstead in a recent story wrote that some people feel it makes more sense to spend money and really concentrate on improving the circumstances that some of these folks who do commit these crimes, the circumstances that they're in, economic, educational opportunities. These are the things that people think money should be spent on as a way to, make the crime rate decline, so to speak. They also say that the government is already, the state government, are already increasing the amount of money that they spend on prison alternatives for people who are arrested for nonviolent drug offenses. So those are some of the approaches that people would like to see as opposed to, you know, evaluating these sort of tough on crime bills, evaluating, you know, what effect they may have on a particular minority.
So another story making news in Wisconsin this week is the withdrawal of a proposed bill that would have changed child support laws. Can you catch us up on that one?
Right. So this is one of those pieces of legislation that started out more or less below the radar, and then it really exploded, as the case may be. It was supposed to have a public hearing, and the bill in question that we're talking about was written by Oconomowoc Republican Joel Clayfish, and it basically capped child support payments for parents making a certain amount of money. Now, that in of itself is not what made it controversial, the fact that it deals with child support payments. What makes it controversial is that the Wisconsin State Journal and Milwaukee Journal Sentinel obtained documents that showed Clayfish worked closely with one person in particular in writing that bill. And that person was a wealthy donor to both he and his wife's campaigns, Michael Izenga, who it turns out stood to benefit directly from a change in law.
And as a result, Clayfish withdrew that legislation. Is there anything that happened after that?
Right. So he did issue a statement this week saying that that legislation was withdrawn after this uproar. And, you know, this issue of child support reform may come up again in the legislature, albeit maybe in a different form. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has said it may be revisited in the next session, that there may be public support for some kind of, child support reform.
Any indication of whether there will be any further ramifications for Clayfish himself?
At this point, it's unclear. You know, all I can say is the legislation had been withdrawn. As for the future of that particular bill, you know, who knows?
All right. And WPR News has some new projects coming up, and one of them involves a new series from reporters Chuck Kornbach and Gilman Halstead. We just heard the first installment today on Central Time. Gilman's in studio with us now to talk about the series and what we can expect down the road. Hey, Gilman, thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
Well, we just heard the first in what's going to be an ongoing series about gun violence in Wisconsin. What are you hoping to cover in the series?
Well, it may narrow a little bit more from our original idea, but the idea is to track each homicide as it happens throughout this over this calendar year, and try to put it in some context for where it happened and why it happened, and then look at the law enforcement policies surrounding the use of guns that have an impact on that. So that's sort of the main idea. I mean, when Chuck Kornbach actually came up with this idea, and one of the phrases that he's used in referring to what we're trying to do is to track what you might call slow motion mass murder. Because by the end of the year, we're going to be looking at, last year was 166. We'll see how close we get to gun homicides this year, and look at how, why, and where they happened in the state.
And what do you think makes this the right year to be pursuing this series?
Well, I mean, we could have done it last year, but I think the national media focus and media attention on, mainly it's on mass shootings, has helped to increase what has been an ongoing debate about gun rights and gun control. And so we're going to be looking at how that debate relates to the number of murders that are actually going on. So there are lots of things involved. We will also be trying to keep track of, you know, whether there are any of these murders that happen in which a person had a concealed carry permit, for example. That's something that's just within the last 2 years in Wisconsin become an issue, and we've had some cases already. So those are really the sort of current hook for it.
And do you have any ideas in the pipeline for what we might be hearing next?
Yes, I know Chuck Kornbach is looking into doing a story on this ShotSpotter technology that's being used in Milwaukee. In fact, just yesterday, the legislature gave Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn some more money to expand the use of that, which is putting microphones in areas where shootings have gone on and trying to get it allows police to get to the area quicker because the technology, I think, has GPS attached to it so they can find out where it is, get there, get the investigation done, and perhaps it will deter in the same way that video cameras, which have also been used, are put up to deter violent crimes.
Well, Gilman, thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to hearing your next pieces.
Thanks for having me.
And Noah, thanks, and see you next Friday.
We'll see you next Friday.
Noah Obchinsky is WPR's assistant news director, and Gilman Halstead is a reporter on staff.
Coming up, why the rise of countries like India and China could mean good news for the United States. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. It's Central Time on a Friday.